Hi, my name is Gary, and welcome to this Robin or Sherwood podcast based on the 1980s series starring Michael Pride and Jason Connery. What we do here is discuss aspects of the series in depth. There is also an excellent podcast that discusses the episode, so if you've not heard that, give it a listen.
So, I'm joined by Dan and Karen.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
And we're going to give a general introduction to Robin or Sherwood today. So, it's been 36 years, almost to the day since the first episode aired. And let's just talk a little bit about 1984. What was the TV landscape like at that time when this new Robin Hood series burst through the trees, shall we say? How do you think it changed it from stuff like A-Team and Knight Rider and those kind of American shows that were around at that time and popular?
Yeah, I mean, the TV back then, I remember, was heavily satirized with American formulaic TV like what you mentioned there. The British equivalent, to me, just seemed to be full of light entertainment shows and quiz shows and largely sort of children's TV. But I don't know how you feel about that.
I think... Yeah, I mean, Ross was probably the answer to all the American shows in a sense. I mean, it hadn't come out of nowhere because you'd had Dick Turpin and various other series that had been shown late afternoon previously. But I'm just trying to think of an hour-long show that was in the same sort of slot, and nothing springs to mind.
Yeah, everything else that Kip had done had been like 30 minutes. So he used to say that it was a luxury to have an hour to tell a story.
Sure.
But basically,
whether that was deliberate, do you think, with the TV companies, that they're deliberately doing a UK riposte to the American shows? I don't know.
I think it probably had something to do with an average American show took up an hour on TV with adverts. So you had like 45 minutes, 50 minutes of A-Team or whatever. And they were just kind of thinking, we'll sell it to that market. But I think British TV at that time, as Dan said, it just was so cheap and cheesy.
Yeah.
And I remember...
You get all things like Russ Abbott's Madhouse, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Plot and, I don't know, Grumbleweeds and...
Yeah, Cannon and Ball and Little and Long and Grumbleweeds and... From my childhood, I just remember being annoyed by endless sport on a Saturday. It seemed to be from about 10 in the morning until 6 at night. There was no escape.
Right.
So this is why kids used to play outdoors so much.
So we need to do more of this, is what you're saying.
It's just more terrible TV. But like nothing had any budget to it. So you had like Doctor Who on BBC One, which was probably the cheapest TV I've ever seen.
I mean, that really suffered from an incredibly low budget for what they were trying to put together. I mean, this was the period of Doctor Who when it was tragic. Not to put too fine a spin on it, it was tragic.
Yeah, and you had...
Largely studio-based with filming in a quarry over and over again.
Yeah. You had like seven a few years before, but they could only afford five people by the end. It was so cheap. They had cardboard spaceships. But like it was when Robin or Sherwood for me came on, it looked like it cost $1 million per episode.
Yeah.
It looked like
which is about right, isn't it?
And I remember laughing because I had the TV Times a few years back for the Greatest Enemy, and we had like I looked at the TV schedule and it said that 5 o'clock you've got the Grumbleweeds radio show and then you've got the Greatest Enemy and after that is Different Strokes. And I was kind of like, guys, we're going a bit around in genres here, quality here. But like it was mostly game shows and light entertainment.
You've got to remember what an impact though the Greatest Enemy would have had being sandwiched between those two shows.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you go to your parents distraught and say, Robin just died, and you hear from the TV, what you talking about, Willis? You're kind of like, shut up, Coleman.
Yeah.
And this was a time of four television channels, wasn't it? And I think The Greatest Enemy had 11 million viewers.
Ooh, yeah. they were getting a lot of viewers.
Channel 4 had been released by then, hadn't it? We got Channel 4 by then, yeah.
It was around that time, but that was the edgy channel and stuff, as I recall.
Yeah.
And like, showed stuff like Excalibur and stuff like that, the more edgy stuff, shall we say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there was a lot of stuff, but, I mean, it's interesting to talk about Turpin and how it influenced Ross, I think. So, like, you could really see, if you see Dick Turpin, if you can see it, because it can be quite hard to find nowadays, but it is on DVD, you can see some of the Robin of Sherwood elements that Richard Carpenter managed to develop into Ross, I think.
You've got to remember, I mean, Turpin was also, as far as I'm aware, extremely successful.
Yeah.
But... I've never researched this, but it's blatantly obvious to me that it clearly influenced one of Adam Ant's looks. Oh. The whole Dandy Highwayman video, I mean, it could basically be Turpin.
Pretty much.
So, you know, it was highly influential. It was highly successful. And I imagine when Kip's coming off that, which had only finished a few years before, and he's pitching his Robin Hood idea, which he'd been mulling around for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
It was probably right person, right place, right time, and they are prepared to let him have the big books to play with. Mm. You know, that whole team, the whole Gaetan team, not obviously not just Kip. He wasn't a person on his own. The whole team had basically proved their mettle, hadn't they? So
with Turpin, I mean, what the only thing that's odd to me is that, like, Robin of Sherwood is well remembered, and Turpin for some reason isn't. And I can't understand that, because it is such a good series. But I guess that just happens sometimes.
Yeah, I think part of it, I think it's... if I was going to say anything, I think the two things that worked in Robin of Sherwood's favour were, one, the hour format. So they could... They just had more room to play with the plots, whereas Turpin had got 30 minutes get in, get out. Yeah. And the other thing I think is the supernatural element, which was new to Robin Hood. And it just came in and gave the whole series so much energy that I think that's one of the reasons that it sort of made such an impact on people, whereas Turpin perhaps didn't.
It was the right thing at the right time, because obviously the New Age movement, which had obviously started in the 70s, but this whole idea about Hearn, the female goddess aspect and so forth, those are all ideas that were being mulled around in literature at the time. So I think Kip was very, very clever to target in on that when he did.
Oh, yeah. I think as well it might just be that it's Robin Hood. Robin Hood is always in the news in one form or another.
Yeah.
So that might have something to do with it. But if you've never seen Turpin, then go out and find it. It's a great show. And it's on right.
Sure.
If you're interested in Robin of Sherwood, of course, you can see the genesis of it in that.
Yeah, there's a direct line you can draw from Turpin to Robin of Sherwood that maybe in Kip's other work, the line's a little more wiggly. But in that one, to me anyway, there's a direct line you can just bring straight through from Turpin to Robin of Sherwood.
Yeah, and you can see a little bit in some of his other shows, like Smuggler, where he's got Robert Addy in it, and what's it called? Eve Benetton as well is in an episode.
Yeah.
So you can see a genesis in Smuggler as well, where they pick up some of the actors they're going to use later in Robin of Sherwood.
It always amazed me, you know, with Robin of Sherwood, that Michael Deakes nor Richard O'Sullivan turned up at any point as guest stars.
Yeah.
Because they were both working at that time. I'm pretty sure O'Sullivan at that point was doing the Me and My Girl? Some sitcom. Michael Deakes around that time was still working, because he was on Galloping Galaxies, which was on Children's BBC, I'm pretty sure.
Sure.
He was playing a robot, because I nearly fell off my chair when I realised it was him. but they were both still working. So, you know, I it was always something I felt a little bit sad that they never actually cast them at some point.
But then again, it would have also been nice to see Jeffrey Bale then.
Yeah, another one. He would have been fabulous. I mean, can you imagine as well if they cast him as a Catweasel type character?
Absolutely, you know.
That would have just been perfect. Just perfect.
I would have loved to have seen that.
Yeah. Season four, people, season four.
Yeah,
but of course, HGV had form as well with After the Britons in the 70s, which was again for its time one of probably the most expensive on location shot action adventure series since The Adventures of Robin Hood.
Yeah,
I think that's why they went with HGV.
Yeah, because you'd think on the face of it, Central would have been a good one for them to have tried to place it with, because obviously Central is the central area, which includes Nottinghamshire.
Yeah.
So you'd have thought that would have been a good one, but obviously HTV are the ones with the experience. So yeah, you go where you go, don't you?
They go with whoever puts up the money.
Well, yeah.
So, like, I believe there was a German company involved in Showtime in the US. And Goldcrest in the UK was quite a big film company at that time. And of course, HDV is the one who seems to get most of the credit from us because of their little logo at the start.
Yeah.
So they get a lot of love. I remember when we were on the conventions near HDV and we used to go past in the coach and everyone would cheer when we went past. It was a nice, funny little memory.
Yeah.
But I mean, there were a lot of things that Kit brought into Ross was shot, as it's known amongst fans, that influenced him. So, for example, we can talk a little about E. Charles Vivian's book and how it's got Simon de Belem in it and a number of elements from the series.
Yeah, because the historical character is Robert de Belem, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
So you can see that Kip's, although he may have come across the historical character, that's not really his primary influence, unless purely he's gone, well, I've already got a Robert De Reno, I don't want another Robert.
I think that's the one.
That is probably it. The last thing you want is too many Roberts running around.
Tell me about it. One of my kids is a Robert.
Well, not yet anymore. Just keep the one. You'll do fine.
Although having a sorcerer called Simon, I don't know whether could quite cut it.
it could have been worse, though. It could have been something like Colin, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Colin Nibbler.
Derek.
If there was a computer game called Simon the Sorcerer a few years after. But
okay.
I think it might just be coincidence. So, I mean, with Robin and Sherwood, I remember at the time I had a lot of clippings and they talked about it as being like a Western in the Greenwood. And I think it's interesting to think about how those movies that Kit would have grown up with might have influenced it. So you can kind of see the outlaws as like the Indians and the soldiers as the cavalry. They've even got
it's completely escaped me. There's something Seven.
Yeah, the Magnificent Seven.
That's it. Wasn't there some sort of idea that the Merrys were sort of like them?
They based Hearn's son on the Magnificent Seven, where he kind of goes around and recruits them.
Yeah. And, but I mean, that is a lot to do with the standard Robin Hood recruitment story anyway, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of a little bit like that, and Kip did allude to that at the time, that he kind of took the Magnificent Seven, which was based on Seven Samurai, which if you've seen that, you can recognize in Swords of Wayland as a homage a lot of the shots. But I think a lot of the stuff at the time, they were kind of trying to appeal to those kind of action adventure type kids who'd grown up on Star Wars and Indiana Jones and the type of thing where it's always kind of moving and there's a lot of humor and action. So I think that kind of 70s films and the 80s films that were kind of like that really gave a lot of the structure.
Wasn't it that when Kip tried to sell the series to the Americans at Showtime, he described it as being Dukes of Hazzard with bows?
Yeah,
they all bought it. Because couldn't be any less like the Dukes of Hazzard, really. It was almost a ridiculous phrase.
The thing with the Dukes, you have to remember, which seems funny now, possibly, but it was absolutely probably the biggest show on TV.
Yeah,
my dad used to love it. I'm pretty sure that's to blame for why I missed seeing almost the entire first series of Ross when it was first broadcast.
And I believe about 5 or 10 years ago, they re-showed Dukes of Hazzard on one of the channels in America, and it was the number one show again.
Wow.
It's obviously, it was a clever thing, Kip said, even back then, to sell Robin.
That's the broad parallel is you've got the Dukes who are, you know, a little bit cheeky and on the wrong side of the law, and then you've got Roscoe P. Coltrane and who have sort of the sheriff and Gisborne role, haven't you?
Yeah.
But I mean, it's such a broad comparison to make that I don't think it's entirely successful.
No. I mean, he basically latched onto what was popular at the time and said it's kind
of... He just said whatever he needed to get that cash. Fair play to him.
clearly, at some point, it worked, although I don't know if it worked with those guys. So basically, as I understand it, what they did was they went around and I believe they just took some stills from the show and they went to all these TV conventions and just basically sold it to all these different countries.
Sure.
So they kind of had... They did really well just based on that. Then it burst onto TV and was a huge success, which is why we're still talking about it, even after all these years.
Yeah.
We're not bored yet.
Can't shut us up, to be honest.
No, God no, we've tried.
And people have tried.
It just didn't work. Right, okay, so what do you most like about this show? What do you think its appeal is?
Its appeal to me... I think when I boil it down, is the interplay between the characters. That's what keeps me coming back, is the fact that the characters are so strong and they feel like real, living, breathing people. And it's that that keeps me coming back. You know, the plots, you know, are fine, but a lot of them, what actually works for me is that the heart, you know, and just the fact that they're a real family, the Marys, and they respect each other, even though they're all very different. And it is just that, you know, just the little interplays. They're not necessarily driving the plot forward, like the little games in Sherwood or whatever. And they're all the bits that keep me coming back, I've got to be honest, after all this time.
God damn it, Karen. What am I supposed to say now?
Sorry.
Exactly what I was going to say. Now, Dan, you talk while I think.
Sure. I think for me, I mean, I wasn't a fan of Robin Hood per se. I wasn't, but I think I was largely, you know, dissatisfied with the way that he was presented up until Robin. I mean, I was, you know, I think the Outlaws, it showed the Outlaws had a higher purpose and more than just being rebels. It showed you why they were rebels and what their purpose actually was. I mean, I was a very quiet child with, you know, with, I think quite a strong moral compass. So I really identified with the conviction and the charisma that Robin had and that whole leadership quality that he was bringing these guys from different situations. And that kind of appealed. Again, Kip called it the outsider character. These were all kind of different individuals wouldn't necessarily have merged on a daily basis, and they were just drawn together by fate. That's one of the elements I quite like.
God damn it, Dan. I've got nothing to say now. No, it's okay. I shall ad lib. Well, I mean, the first thing that appealed to me was visually. As we said before, it didn't look like anything else on TV.
Yeah.
It's shot on film. It looked like it cost a lot of money, and you could flip over from Paul Daniels or whatever, and you suddenly were in Sherwood Forest, which was a lot more fun, I can tell you. As Karen said, you have the characters and how they interplay with each other.
And
I don't think I'd seen anything where the drama really felt that real. You know, it had a reality to how they interacted to it that I hadn't really seen in anything else at that point.
Yeah.
So on that, in that regard, I was totally invested in it in a way that I wasn't with anything else. So, and I think as well, you have to say it didn't sound like anything else because of Clannad's music.
Sure.
So immediately, if you imagine you're going from something like the Different Strokes music straight into Clannad, there's a major difference here in how something sounds. So you were really in a different place in front of TV. It was just totally fresh.
If Clannad hadn't been available, how do we think the series would have actually worked, or would it have worked? Judging by the fact that at the time, a lot of period drama was using almost classical scores.
I think originally, weren't Clannad just to do the title song?
Oh, really? Okay.
And then they said, well, actually, we can do the whole thing or something.
Right.
I understand it. And Paul Knight said, yeah, do it. And that's when we got the Legend album. But I believe they said that if Clannad hadn't been available, it probably would have been Dennis King who did the score.
Oh, yeah.
Turpin.
Black Beauty.
Yeah, and stuff.
Yeah.
Which would have
makes been sense.
Fun. He might have written a really beautiful score to it, but it would not have that extra magical element in it, I don't think. That
It's like Clannad's an extra character in the show.
Yeah.
You know, with the music.
So
I think if you lost them, it would definitely have lost something, even if they produced, somebody else produced the best score that has ever been known to man, and we thought that was brilliant, it still would have lost something.
It would have lost the distinctiveness.
Yeah.
I mean, it would still be the same show, but it wouldn't have that distinct sound to it that it has, the way you know instantly, that's Robin of Sherwood.
Yeah.
So again,
well, as soon as you got the opening bars, didn't you? You got the HTV bing bong, and then as soon as it went into the opening bars, that was it. You were there. You were in Sherwood. You were ready to go.
I mean, as well as this sounds funny, but I always liked the HTV intro because living in Yorkshire, I never saw that anywhere else.
Yeah. No, I was the same. I loved it.
Pure Ross to me.
I never associated it with any other show.
Yeah, and it had just come on. You'd be like, yay, it's Robin of Sherwood time. So, yeah, I mean, the music, the characters, the way it was shot, it didn't look like anything else. That's pretty much what appealed to me. And then, of course, you had the storylines. And a lot of the storylines, I think, have really stood the test of time in so many ways.
Sure.
Most of them, not all of them.
Well, you've got the supernatural element being added, haven't you, which we hadn't seen before with the Robin Hood legend. So that was adding an extra dimension to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really did enhance it. So, yeah, I mean, you'd come out of Robin of Sherwood and then into Coronation Street or something, and it would just be so weird. It was like being in two different worlds. So, yeah. Which, out of all the characters, we've talked a lot about that we love the way the characters interact. Who are your favourites?
Well, mine's Will Scarlet. Always has been. I don't think can't see that changing. I just think, there's lots of other characters that I really do like. Gisborne's one, for example. But I just think with Scarlet, I mean, you've got the, you know, he's a soldier, da, 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 da. But you've got there's so many layers to that character. It's almost like peeling an onion. And Ray, just his performance throughout was just outstanding. I don't think he's ever bettered it. You know, he just brought so much to it. Because on paper, that character could have been the bully boy that the papers always used to say he was when they clearly hadn't been paying attention nor watching it properly. You can tell I'm still bitter about that, can't you? but he brought so much to that role. So he's always my standout. I think Little John as well, another fabulous character that on paper is very dry. not a lot to it. But again, Clive just brought so much to that role, really just inhabited it totally and was just fabulous. So yeah, they'd be my standouts, I think.
I don't think I can add very much to that, apart from maybe the sheriff, Nick Gracie's sheriff, particularly though in the first series really stood out. As good in the second, and I thought he lost it slightly in the third, came back again maybe a little bit for a few episodes, but I just love how individual he made the character, you know, so sarcastic, so witty, you know, this really put upon cleric, was just trying to survive in this changing world. And again, the interplay with Robert Addies Gisburn was absolutely outstanding. Just some of the best episodes, and you don't associate Robin of Sherwood with humour, but also at the same time, it was a big important part of the series, and just the witticisms that Kip wrote for the characters, it was just made it pop off the page.
Yeah, if we can go back to Will Scarlet for a minute, I do remember at the time there was a lot of stuff saying he's just a cook, Rice Stallone, and stuff like that. And just, I think it's something that people have appreciated as the years have gone by, just how good Ray was in that role. You know, he really was the kind of catfish in the group that really forced the dynamic to be interesting by questioning everything and making the leader role more interesting in the process. And I think in terms of the sheriff, it was a new kind of sheriff, because as you said, he was also very funny, but you could kind of relate to him and how he was a little bit, because of the way Nick Grice played him. He just had the kind of charisma to him.
Yeah.
Even when he was doing really bad things, he made it entertaining to watch. He wasn't just evil, shall we say. And of course, Gisburn.
I've got to say, you know, when I'm thinking about it, there actually wasn't any character in the show who was a duffer. You know, even if you think Much or Tuck, who probably character-wise had less to do and less, you know, less big storylines and that kind of stuff. I mean, even those two are bringing so much more to their roles than you'd been getting in previous incarnations. That, yeah, it was, you take anybody out of the Ross pie, if you like, and it's not going to work as well, is it?
Well, that's it. I mean, because there were only seven outlaws, they were each got their own time on screen. And their individual characters. So they really worked so well together that you, as you said, you couldn't really take anyone out. It was just the right amount of characters without that group, I think. And if you bring a new character in, like you had Martin come in, but he didn't need to have any lines, you know, with the seven of them. You had Tom and Dickon in the start, and that kind of worked, but it was because it was the start. And they were fine characters. But again, I mean, seven is good. Nine is maybe too many.
Yeah, they. I mean, Martin was a bit of a shame, really, that they didn't do something with that character. Yeah. Even if it was just in the next series, they just went, oh, you know, Martin's got married and, I don't know, bogged off to Barnsley or something. It was just the fact he got forgotten about that was just... It was a bit sad, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't miss him. That was the thing. It wasn't like you were going, hang on a minute, where that guy's gone. And that in itself was quite tragic.
Yeah. I think Ian Sharp introduced him for some reason and just kept him around. But he didn't really need to be there, unfortunately.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what they were thinking. Because obviously it's another guy on screen and it's another guy taking wages. What, you know, was there initially some thinking that they were going to do something with him?
They had him in case they had to kill anyone off.
So,
yeah, like a red, like the red shirts in Star Trek.
Yeah, they kind of had him for that, I'm thinking, unfortunately. But I would have loved to have seen him built up.
Because there's the Alan Adale debate, isn't it? They are always thinking of introducing Alan Adale as a regular character, and that didn't quite pan out. So I imagine that Martin was... another try at the same idea.
Yeah. I mean, because Alan Dale's quite a major character, isn't he, in the ballads?
Mm.
But, I mean, even if we set aside the problems with that characterisation of Alan Dale and Robin Sherwood, I can't see how a character of Alan Dale as a bard or musician or however you're putting him, how that is going to fit into our Robin of Sherwood.
Yeah.
Because it almost like adds a superficiality and a jolliness to it that wasn't there.
Yeah.
You know, what's he going to do apart from sing? That was his character trait.
I mean, he could be a spy, but then that's kind of the occupation of Tuck. That's what Tuck does. And he goes into Nottingham dressed as a monk. So, yeah, like you say.
I've always thought that a funny idea, because if anyone is going to be recognised, it's Tuck.
True.
They're going to spot him literally a mile off.
If you think about all of them, though, I mean, you've got Little John, who's considerably taller than everybody else, so he's quite easy to spot. You've got Tuck, who's a fat monk, so he's quite easy to spot as well. And then you've got Marion, who's the token woman, so she's quite easy to spot. You've got Nazir, who's the Saracen, so everyone's going to be going, oh look, it's a foreigner, so he's quite easy to spot as well. So there's only really a couple of them who could sort of be fairly incognito. So as a group of like who's supposed to be hiding out in the woods, they're a bit rubbish.
Mm. Yeah, they are kind of recognisable.
On the group a while back about Robin being kind of a trickster master of disguise type character, because of course in through the series you've got Loxley being Hedda of Castleton. He's also got a dual role in what am I thinking of, Lord of the Trees, where as the mummer as well, and there's a couple of other ones with Jason's Robin as well, where he has that kind of dual character role. Yeah. I think they should have played with that a little bit more.
He does it a little bit in Swords of Wayland as well. If you drop into a West Country accent, no one will know who the hell you are. But no, I think if I'm talking favourites, it's very difficult for me because, as said, they're all so good. But I think I would have to go with Robin himself, Mister of Loxley, because he just seems to be the ultimate hero. He's he has somewhere to go as a character, and he kind of develops. He makes mistakes, but he's also someone who's driven. He's focused on his goal. He's got so many sides to him, and at the end he makes the ultimate sacrifice. So he's really, I think, a top-notch character. That Kip wrote, and it's very difficult to write Robin Hood because he's so goody-goody. But
as we've said before, haven't we? Very hard character it must be to play, because you haven't got anything really to get your teeth into as an actor.
I think with Jason's Robin as well, but particularly with Michael's Robin of Loxley, there was kind of an edge to him, and he would sometimes do things that were kind of a little questionable. For example, at the end of the prophecy with Mark, and you've got to wonder what happens to Mark, but my suspicion is it wasn't anything pretty.
No.
The way that Robin looks at him at the end and kind of smiles, and you're thinking, oh God, you're in for something now, and it's probably very sharp.
Strangely, in the Canadian cut of the series, I believe, I only have the Janet's word for it here, but they actually didn't, where it cuts to Michael turning around and seeing Mark in the background there, they didn't have that scene in there. So it implies that Mark had been drowned by Loxley.
Drowned, yeah. Well, I
think it's not possibly in the novel as well.
Yeah, but I imagined that Robin just finished him off.
Yeah.
Because what else can you do with him? He knows where the camp is. Yeah. He knows a lot of stuff, and he's a traitor.
Yeah.
It should be sleep tight, you. You sleep with the fishes tonight.
Thank you.
So, I would go with Robin of Loxley for that one. But what I also like about it very much is his relationship to Much and how he cares for his younger stepbrother and how Much just worships Robin. I think that really is something that, as I've got older, I've really noticed more and more and thought, you know, how he talks to Much and how he is with him is just so loving.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a great relationship throughout the whole series. So that is something that also I think is really good. So we've discussed characters we like in Robin of Sherwood. Are there any that you're less fond of?
What, we're talking main characters or guest characters or anybody?
Any characters whatsoever.
I think my least favourite out of the Merrys is Nazir. I just don't feel, in terms of a character, I ever really got a handle on who he was or what his motivations were or anything like that, really. He was you know, he was like a killing machine. It's like, yeah, but so what? You know, I never really quite got that handle on, you know, why when he was freed from Belem, why didn't he go back to the Holy Land? You know, I never really gelled with him. He's probably my least favourite out of the Merrys, but I'll have a think about which is my least favourite in general, and you guys can have a go.
No.
I think you're probably right. Out of the Merrys, it probably would be for me the Nazir character, because I felt that there was only a limited way that you could go with him. We developed this idea that he was from the Hashishin sect of assassins. And to me, that is great, but that doesn't seem to be a very noble profession. So,
wasn't there something in the Writer's Bible about Nazir where he was a prince in his own land or something?
Yeah.
And he was also married.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, to the lovely Fatima.
Fatima.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just, if he's a prince, you know, why not go? Why are you living in a forest in cold England? I don't know. It just, I had more questions, and I didn't feel they're ever explored in say the way that Scarlet's character was explored.
I believe I have an explanation for you.
Oh, go on then.
Right. This is vaguely explained in Knights of the Apocalypse, in that one of the knights, sorry, I forget his name, but he's played by Colin Baker in the audio, kills his wife, which leads to the infamous Fatima.
Yeah, that was in the script, wasn't it? But
script.
It didn't make it onto the audio.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, and Nazir is looking for these knights, which he does in the logical manner of sitting in a tree until one happens to pass by.
No, I think that bit made it into the audio, didn't it?
Yeah, that bit did, because he leapt like bad fruit onto Colin Baker. But it might be his motivation is like revenge into that. Oh, I got to stay in England to find these knights, and I know they have a preceptory in Lincoln or whatever they do.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole Knights of the Apocalypse idea wasn't it the fact that they're like Templars, who set off the Templars who are in the Holy Land, basically being the police.
Something.
I don't know, but surely it would make more sense if you're going out for revenge, go where they are rather than wait for them to come to you.
I don't know.
I haven't listened to that. I've listened to the audio once, and I've read the script once. So I wouldn't say it's something that I'm familiar enough with to wax lyrical on, really.
No, it was just something that was impossible. I just loved the idea that he'd wait up a tree for someone to pass by.
I mean, don't you wait up a tree every day just for someone to pass by? I mean, I know I do.
I sit in my garden every day waiting for Jessica Alba to walk past.
Has she done it yet?
Not yet.
No,
I'm losing the will to carry on, to be honest. It's just taking too long. But yeah, there you go. I guess I better answer my own goddamn question.
Yeah, that'll teach you.
Yeah, becoming a conversation with myself. Right, okay. Characters I don't like. Well, I think I'll go for the obvious one and say that after Hanson, I'm not so fond of Golnar.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to do with the actor. It's to do with how he's written. So we have this kind of mad sorcerer who seems just to have come from a different planet. It's basically if you put Mork from Ork in Robin of Sherwood, you kind of get this crazy sorcerer who's just totally off the wall, totally nuts. And it just doesn't seem to match with Jason Connery's Robin. He seems like someone like Bellem, who's a lot more calm and threatening, could possibly pass. But then they've done Bellem, and he's a Locksley villain, so they couldn't use him for some reason. But yeah, I kind of think it's a stretch too far in Robin of Sherwood when you have this stick-thin sorcerer wandering around recreating lost villages and stuff. It's taking the magical aspect too far, and it's vastly overplayed, which was apparently the fault of the director who instructed Richard O'Brien to play it like that.
I can't imagine anyone really having that much control over Richard O'Brien, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I know it was that Richard Carpenter, because he said in one interview, he said, why should I bother writing a realistic character when he's just going to go off the wall like that? So he is kind of annoyed by it all. But I would definitely go with Golnar as someone I'm less fond of as a character. And to be honest, as you said, I mean, most of them were, I never had any problem. I don't have any problem with the Nazir character. I think he's a nice addition. But he is...
Yeah, I don't have a problem with him.
Just because we don't know anything about him, he's not really, he doesn't have a lot of dialogue. I think if you put Nazir on his own and gave him some adventures, it could be like A Fistful of Dollars or something where you have like, he's kind of the Clint Eastwood type character. I think that would be really cool. That might work really well. But in the group, he can be kind of lost sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we'd have got the legendary season 4, there were again more opportunities to develop Nazir more. They'd obviously been trying to give him more lines as the character learns better English and try and use Mark Ryan a little bit more and give a little variety. And that was absolutely fab. And I do think they should be applauded for the fact that they were doing it gradually rather than, you know, just like, I don't know, season 3 opener and Nazir's suddenly a completely different character who's having a chat with everybody. Yeah. You know, it was really nice that they took the time and built that up slowly. And it showed a lot of respect for the character, I think, that they did that. And, you know, you can only hope that they were going to go further in season 4. So it's not that I dislike the character. That would be putting far too much emphasis. I would just say, if I had to pick my least favourite Merry, he would be it, I think. But yeah, I was just thinking, who's my least favourite guest star? I'm guessing it's probably Matt Frewer, to be honest. Sure. De Karnak.
Yeah.
I don't even hate Golnar. You know, I just thought that was a bit of fun and he was so off the wall. So I felt there was a sense of like jeopardy with him. You didn't know where it was going or what the hell was going to happen. No. And I did quite like that. But De Karnak and Matt Frewer, I didn't like the Canadian accent that jarred. Yeah, I just didn't like it.
Didn't he get the job because he was like Jason's friend or something? Wasn't that part of the reason they cast him, so that Jason was a bit more comfortable for the first couple of weeks or something? I heard that.
I've not heard that, but yeah, it stands to reason, I suppose, yeah.
It might be.
I know Amanda Hillwood, Matt Frewer's wife, was cast probably because it was ever a known person on the series already.
Ah, okay. Who did she play? I can't remember.
She played Martin's mother.
In Adam Bell.
Yeah.
Right.
I was thinking, because we've been talking, I was thinking Martin the Outlaw then. I was thinking, yeah, I was blimey, like she was must like, be, he must have an older lady. Yeah, okay. Yeah, all right, yeah.
I think for me, character-wise, I didn't particularly like the Philip Mark character. I think he was a lost opportunity because, of course, Philip Mark was a legitimate historical sheriff of Nottingham. And I think they could have used that character over a space of at least two or three different episodes and mix it up a little bit more and give Nicholas Grace's sheriff a bit of a rest, you know, see how he fares, you know, out of from being the sheriff for a little bit longer. Because with Robin of Sherwood, unfortunately, you tended to have a story reset every single, at the end of every episode, a reset back to square one. There wasn't this, there was fluidity throughout the series, but not as much as you get in later series.
No, it was very much of its time in that regard.
It was sort of at the beginning of series having story arcs, wasn't it, really? From what I remember. So you had it a little bit in Robin of Sherwood, but it was really, the kind of idea was in its infancy.
Yeah, it just wasn't something you did until, like, the Next Generation did it a little bit, and then you got stuff like Buffy after that where it did it a lot, and everyone was like, oh my God, I can't wait for the next episode, just to find out because we weren't used to it.
Yeah,
you only got soap operas
with Ross. I mean, you know, there's lines, isn't there, that the Marys are dropping in, which refer back to previous episodes previous incidences. But it'll be just like an odd line. So if you aren't following it, that would just go over your head, and there's no sort of detriment, is there? It's not driving the plot forward.
Yeah.
And also you had, I mean, the main plot thing that continued through a whole season was, of course, the thing with Robin and Will in series two.
But again, you could ignore that totally.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not going to ruin the series, is it? Like, you're not going to jump into the Swords of Wayland and go, hang on a minute, what's happened with those two? Or it didn't really matter, did it?
Well, the thing is, the episodes were out of sequence for decades and it never bothered us.
No, which proves the point, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it was never a problem. I mean, Children of Israel, where they resolved the conflict, was like episode two for years. So it was never anything to complain about in terms of, wait, what the? Not like in America, where they'd have a Jason episode and a Michael episode back to back without Greatest Enemy and Hanser.
They must have been that just. They must have been so confused. Yes. And can you imagine? Like, it's not like you can get the internet and go, you know, Google it and go, what now?
Yeah.
You know, they're just flicking about between different actors.
They were like, well, what happened to his hair?
Yeah.
When did he get that done?
Yeah. I've missed the episode where he bleached it.
Yeah. Well, how did he get bleached? It must be magic. So, I mean, we didn't have that problem, at least. Yeah. I don't have any other characters that I really dislike at all, which is a testament to how well-written it was and how well-made. Do you have any favourite scenes or moments that really made you love it? At what point did you realise this thing's going to be around a long time for you, so to say?
I think for me, probably the Swords of Wayland is a standout episode. The way it's filmed, you can just put that up on a cinema screen and it just will look so fresh today. The imagery they're playing about with the Dark Riders and the red backgrounds there, I mean, that's very sort of folkloric. It has a deep folk horror undertones to it. I think that was probably a standout one for me.
Yeah, the scene that really made me love Robin Sherwood, I think, is in the the scene where he takes Marion to Kirkley's.
Yeah,
and she's on the white horse, and there's no dialogue, and it just plays "Now Is Here," the song.
Mm.
If you don't know, and they don't talk. There's just, you can see there's this connection between them, and then she goes into the nunnery. It's about a 2-minute scene or something. And that scene was just something that so resonated with me for some reason, image-wise, that I think that was when I really fell in love with it. And there's lots of scenes like that, but that is the one I most remember thinking, wow, this thing is really, really beautifully made.
I think for me, to be a cliche, the moment when it went over from being a TV show that I loved to being something I was deeply affected by and, you know, was going to stick with me my whole life was obviously The Greatest Enemy. I just remember just being so, I suppose traumatized isn't too strong a word, after it had finished. I mean, when you're watching it, when you're that kind of age, you know, you're not even a teenager, very, very young. And it's the first major character death I can remember seeing on screen. And, you know, you've been watching the series and you've loved it. And you know, it's been like you've made a date with the TV every week that you're going to watch it, and you've sat down and you've watched it. And then they've killed off your favourite character. I mean, that's the moment that you're going to carry with you your whole life, I think.
The swines.
That's the thing I miss about TV now, is that the having to wait, the sense of expectation that you have to wait for another week. And if you don't sit down and watch it then, you've missed it. You probably won't ever see it again. You know, it's it's technology is fantastic, but also at the same time, it's removed that expectation.
Yeah, I've got to say, I was disappointed on one level when they just released the new series of The Last Kingdom and they released it in one glut, yeah, rather than releasing an episode a week, which they had been doing with Outlander, which I've been watching as well. And I was actually disappointed to get my whole The Last Kingdom cake it as one blob. I wanted a slice a week, please.
If only Mary revived Robin with her chest.
Now I may overdose on Uhtred and Finan, and I'm sorry, that is not a good thing.
Uhtred and Finan, it sounds like some kind of medicine. Characters or what?
Believe me, it is a medicine.
Well, then it works on so many levels. I don't know what Last Kingdom is, so I'm trying to guess.
Oh, Gary, we need to take your Last Kingdom virginity. I'm sorry, my boy.
I'm sorry, I'm not that kind of guy. But no, I mean, it's interesting to look at what effect The Greatest Enemy had and how many psychiatrists have a little thank you note to Kip stuck on their wall. You know.
I think there's a whole generation of us that were deeply affected on quite a cellular level by that.
I can imagine some 40-something going in and laying down and the psychiatrist saying, okay, what happens to be the problem? And he says, it was 1985 and he's saying that again. But no, I mean, if you're looking at favourite episodes, then certainly the first two series are super strong, I think. And a lot of the third, and we can talk about what's right and wrong about that at some point, what we think. But I think in terms of favourites, it's really hard to pick one for me. But as Dan said, I think I'd go with probably where Robin of Sherwood was pure Robin of Sherwood. Was probably The Swords of Wyland for me.
I mean, in terms of an episode, I mean, that, because I would put The Greatest Enemy on one side with that, because the Greatest Enemy, if you take away Robin's sacrifice, it's actually quite a slight episode, really. But The Swords of Wyland, I mean, that is almost pitch perfect the whole way through. It's just fab, isn't it?
It's just, even on the DVD, it looks to be on the Blu-ray, I should say, it looks to be of a higher quality, you know, in terms of the picture and stuff. I don't know why, if they had a bigger budget and the characters are dressed slightly differently in parts of it. So I don't know what was going on there.
I'm guessing they might have, you know, because even the fact of them going on location to Cornwall, which wasn't their normal sets. I mean, they've structured their series budget and gone, well, we're setting aside X amount for this episode. I don't know. But I mean, even just putting the cast in buses or whatever and the crew and moseying up to Cornwall, that's taking extra money, isn't it?
Yeah, and they also went up to Northumberland for some of the other episodes as well for series.
Yeah.
So they
used Northumberland more, didn't they? I mean, that would have been, you know, a couple of weeks filming probably Northumberland to use all the different places like Bamborough, Alnwick, Brinkburn, like Cornwall's just going to be for this one episode, isn't it?
I think they spent about 2 weeks down there.
Yeah.
At one point I had, this is how much of a nerd I was, or am, I should say. I went on holiday to Penzance, and while I was there, I raided the newspaper archives, and there was this very interesting... Yeah, because I was a total nerd. So I went, and you could go on microfilm, and you could look stuff up, and I looked at all the stuff, and the cast was there, and what they were recording and stuff. And
I'd never have thought of doing that, you know. Hats off.
Young mind, fresh ideas.
Yeah.
Now, at some point... Going on from realizing that if you went on microfilms in individual towns, you could find stuff. It occurred to me that Nottingham was a good place to go.
Yeah.
This is the most obvious one.
Yeah.
So I went down to Nottingham and I went to the library and I said, I want to use the microfilms. What are you looking for? I'm looking for Robin O'Shea's stuff. The librarian went, oh, come with me. I was like, whoa, what's going to happen here? And she took me to the site, which is not as interesting as you might be imagining at this point, and pulled out a folder and just passed it me and said, have a look at this.
Right.
And what it was they had collected clippings about Robin Hood over so many years.
Wow.
And of course, there was a whole Robin of Sherwood section, which I photocopied at that time because you could.
Yeah.
And there was all sorts in there. There was like trips to Sherwood Forest with lots of photos, you know, with the cast and Jason Connery's visit there in 1985. And apparently what happened was he rode out of the castle gates on a white horse or something as Robin.
Okay.
Which I can't find anything else about, but it sounded great if I could. And of course, all the cast went to Sherwood in late 85. There were loads of photos from that. There was just all sorts like reviews and interviews. Michael visited Sherwood or something with Kip, and there were photos and articles about that. There was just, it was like a gold mine of stuff.
Right.
But I want to say, before anyone organizes a coach and runs off to Nottingham, that I don't know if the folder is still there, and most likely if you go to Nottingham Library and log on, you can probably just look at it online, okay? I don't want to be responsible for all these people turning up in Nottingham demanding this mythical folder that may not exist.
Yeah, the folder probably doesn't exist, does it? Whether they've put it online is a different matter.
It's more than likely, because nowadays one thing I sometimes, when I get chance to do, is you can go on newspaper archives and find a ton of stuff.
Yeah, the Nottingham one's Nottingham Evening Post.
Yeah.
I know
there were like worksop papers as well that had got clippings, little papers.
Yeah.
So
my aunt used to get the Nottingham Evening Post, but if I remember rightly, and I could be wrong on this, it was out twice a week and she only used to get it on Thursdays.
Yeah.
But if there were any sort of Robin Hood, Robin of Sherwood clipping, she would give them to me, which I have still got, but I haven't got anything about the cast visiting Sherwood. I know it happened.
I think that was the worksop one that did that.
Yeah.
But of course, I'm remembering back.
Yeah, because, well, Sherwood is nearer worksop than... Yeah,
it just made sense that they would cover it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the point is that as fans, we sometimes go above and beyond for this our obsession with this show.
Yeah. The Northumberland papers might well have quite a lot as well.
Yeah, I've never been up
there. And the Bristol ones.
So I don't know, but the Bristol papers were chock full of useful stuff. I mean, I came home with like bags full of clippings from there. There was like on-set visits, there were reportings from filming. So you were going from 1983 onward there was like all sorts of stuff. It was great. There was the thing with Jason and Ryan Blessed. Where they did the meetup of the two shows, Treasure Island and Robin of Sherwood.
It was press day, wasn't it, for HTV? And they, they two went big to... shows at the time were Return to Treasure Island and Robin of Sherwood.
Yeah, and they did something at the Clifton Suspension Bridge together.
Yeah.
There was some kind of photo there. So there was like tons of stuff, but it was just, I think you can do it online now.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm trying to go back to any scenes that I really liked. As Karen, as you said earlier, I tend to like the scenes between the cast, you know, the interplay. Those are the scenes, like, for example, in Rutterkin, where they're literally horsing around, and then Little John comes and says, I'm leaving, and you have this wonderful scene between all of them where they all say goodbye. Alan Adale on the log is a wonderful... fun scene. There's just the King's Fool, where they're at the banquet.
Now, the Inheritance, where they're sunbathing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of these scenes that would probably get cut now. You know, they'd be like, oh, don't bother that. There's not time. Let's cut it. Sure. We go straight to the action. But in Robin the Sherwood, that's what really makes it good.
Mm.
So I'm not sure. Was the King's Fool, was the banquet scene, was that actually filmed, or did they just put him in the costume and film him on a night out?
Yes.
Because it, I don't know which one it was.
It looked very convincing. I don't think they were drinking apple juice, should we say.
No.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most convincing, slightly tipsy acting I've seen. So, yeah. Maybe they're just damn fine actors.
If you've ever seen a film called Bowfinger... there's a great joke in it. They're trying to make a film, but they can't afford the guest star. So they say, we're just going to walk up to him, say our lines, see how he responds, and then we're going to work the script for whatever he does. And the other guy says, you can't do that. That's not right. And he says, because it's right. They do it all the time. Do you know Tom Cruise didn't know he was in that vampire movie until 2 years later? And it's kind of, I kind of think like that with Richard O'Brien, you know, whether he actually knew he was in it. So, okay.
Stop.
I think we ought to wrap this one up for now. Then this was just a general Robin of Sherwood discussion. So next time we're going to be a bit more specific.
Have you decided on our topic for next time yet?
There are so many possibilities. The problem is deciding between them.
Yeah.
So at some point, I think we're going to have to discuss what might have happened in Series 4.
Yeah.
But also, it's kind of fun to talk about stuff like costume designs and locations and what merchandise came out and that kind of paraphernalia.
Perfect. We could be open to suggestions as well, couldn't we?
Yeah. We could open it up, open them up to the floor. So let's wrap this one up. So we're going to say farewell and hope you enjoyed this little trip down Sherwood Forest Lane. So, okay, farewell.
See you
farewell, next. Blessed be.